Welcome back to the Life on Target podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Spearing, and I'm super excited about today's episode. Our first episode where we interview a guest. Already have several additional guests scheduled for the not too distant future, but it seemed fitting to have Pastor C.R. Wiley on as a guest here because his framework for personal agency, general competency formed the foundation for our very first episodes. If you haven't listened to those, if you're new to the Life on Target podcast, it might be a good opportunity for you to go back and listen to the first couple episodes, the first, I think it was five after episode, the initial episode, and understand this framework, but you will also be able to get a lot from this conversation with Pastor C.R. Wiley, and hope it's beneficial to you. All right, so today I am here with Pastor C.R. Wiley, and I first met Pastor Wiley at a Warriors Tending Garden, my inaugural Warriors Tending Gardens training event. And I had no idea that of the 12 guys participating, two were going to be pastors. So, and many elders in the church as well. So that was encouraging to me to see church leadership serious about, I guess, just guns. And I build it as a theology of violence as well. So I was, I got some photos of the pastor with some guns, and as I thought about it, I think about that pastor that is in the Patriot that says, a pastor must protect the flock. And at sometimes that means fending off the wolves. Right, so I was encouraged by y'all being there and just want to give you a chance to give us a little bit of your autobiography and what brought you to this point. I think it's a credit that you talked on Jonathan West's podcast about not growing up wanting to be a pastor. And so that's an extra score in my book.
Yeah. So Nate, it's great to be with you. Yeah, and that was a real fun event up there in South Dakota. And I enjoyed it very much at the Rifle Ranch up there.
Absolutely. And
that's not the first time I'd ever shot a gun. You know, I've got a few.
Nice.
But I enjoyed it very much. And it was a great thing. I don't know why anybody would not want to own a gun or be able to shoot a gun. I mean, it seems like the sort of thing that as Americans, we should enjoy because we have a right to do it. And it's fun. So then, of course, there are a lot of practical benefits that being able to defend yourself and hunt and all that kind of stuff. So, since I'm from Western Pennsylvania, everybody that I knew back there hunted. Guns were everywhere. All the pastors, were sportsmen. It was just a different kind of place. It was very blue collar. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen, by the way, the film The Deer Hunter?
I haven't. This might get me in trouble with my listeners, but well, they all add that to the list.
Well, you ought to, because it's kind of a Vietnam film, but yep. It's about Western Pennsylvania and some guys got Robert De Niro and Christian Walken and all those guys in it. But it really gives you a picture of what life was like in the 70s in that part of the country. But anyway, I'm kind of running down this rabbit trail or rabbit hole or whatever. I'm C.R. Wiley, as you noted, and people just call me Chris. So you can call me Chris. And in terms of my biography, I'm in the Pacific Northwest now. I live in a town called Battleground, which is kind of a fun place to say you live in.
Absolutely.
And then... I'm just right outside of Portland, Oregon. So I'm in that kind of the greater Portland metro area. And I'm serving a church here. I've been here just a little over a year now. And I've done a lot of different things. I've been a real estate investor and a contractor like you are. And obviously a pastor. And I've also taught philosophy for about 10 years at the college level, undergraduate level.
So which college?
Eastern Nazarene College in Boston.
Okay.
So did that. And now I'm one of the guys on the Theology Podcast, which is another podcast. And anyway, we had you on the show one time.
Absolutely. You're aware that I'm not going to give you the boost in email signups or numbers that the podcast gave me early on in my beginning with Warriors Tending Gardens. So yeah, it was fun. I mentioned on there being kind of intimidated with the cast and even just the listeners being a very philosophy driven and deep theology type stuff. But I think some of the stuff we talked about on there was trying to pull the church back to the martial virtues that we may have strayed from in comfortable times.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, you did a great job. I mean, everybody enjoyed the show. You know, we're basically Glenn and Tom and I, we all kind of have a blue collar mindset. So we're not really academics in the way, the sense that I think many people think about academics. But anyway, so we enjoyed talking about real world stuff and
absolutely
and the martial virtues. I think those are really important.
And then you just had a third book come out, but and this podcast, I think I mentioned to you that I did my first 4 episodes after kind of the introductory episode off of the languages of agency that you talk about in your book, Man of the House, and specifically really love that in talking about agency equaling freedom, equaling the ability to kind of affect your own end state within God's order, not my truth, but what God has said is truth, and then working with inside of his created order as a Christian. Yeah. And so I guess I've mentioned your name probably 50 times on this podcast, but wanted to, you know, you talk about the different topics in the book, but wanted to hear your story, how you arrived at that knowledge of general competency and being something that, because it is unique to have a pastor that's a general contractor. That you talked about on Jonathan's podcast, Being Husband podcast, about how you manage the addition of your church and had to have the theological discussions with your church about why beauty matters, why quality matters. Right. And not to hit too close to home, but we're in the middle of a church remodel here.
Oh, great.
Sometimes feel like that same fight is happening in a pragmatic, Gnostic, you know, not full on like you talked about there, but just that Christians losing that belief that the physical things matter as much as they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad to hear that you're involved in a project. So here's my background. You know, my father was an academic. My mother was really into the arts. They were kind of bohemian in the sense that, you know, everybody is in sort of the college world, kind of surrounding college campuses, kind of artsy, intellectual ivory tower kind of stuff. And this was, you know, so I was born in 1962. So I grew up during the 60s and early 70s when all the crazy stuff was going on with Vietnam War and dropping in and tuning in and dropping out or whatever, you know, it was all that stuff. Yeah. But anyway, so that's kind of the background I'm from, but my family broke up. My father was involved in Scientology and all kinds of crazy stuff. And anyway, long story short, I ended up in Western Pennsylvania, where I had been born and where my ancestors are from on both sides. My mother is McCullough, and then obviously Wiley. So Scots Irish, that's kind of Scots Irish territory there, Northern Appalachia, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, the Ohio River Valley, you know, West, you know, Southeastern Ohio, Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, it's all kind of a same culture in that area, very blue collar hunting, you know, that kind of thing. So I was surrounded during my teen years by a very different sort of man than I had known when I was younger. You know, I was around academics and artists, and then I was around guys who worked, you know, for the railroad and, or in, you know, Pittsburgh Plate and Glass or, you know, that kind of world, those worlds. And those guys were all very manually competent. I mean, they worked on their own cars, they fixed their own houses, they just did everything, you know, themselves. And, you know, back we had, I was converted in a little blue collar church. And, you know, I don't think anybody in the church had
what age was that for you?
That would have been in my late teens.
Okay.
So nobody had I don't think any of them had a college education. You know, they were just really, just, you know, salt of the earth, good hearted people who knew how to do things. Mm-hmm. So when it came time to build a new sanctuary, they just said, well, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So they got a design build company, to work with them, but they did most of the work themselves, everything from laying brick to framing it to, you know, everything. And so I was involved with that, and I was enjoyable. And then when I went to study for the ministry, I went to Boston, met my wife, and then was out in Kansas City. And when I was in Kansas City, my wife's uncle was a big GC there in a commercial properties, basically concrete and steel construction. Okay. And so I went to work for him and was essentially a gopher and, you know, the kind of guy that holds the other end of the board while someone else cuts it.
You were in seminary at the time?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was how you worked your way through seminary.
Well, that was how I started. But then I actually joined in with a bunch of framers. I became a framer with a company that really did sort of a high-end decks. So we built decks all over Kansas City. And that was a lot of fun. So we were all seminary guys. I think there was one guy who wasn't a seminary guy. We go to school in the morning in our trucks. Yep. And then, you know, after we got done with class, we'd hop in the trucks and go to the work site and work for the rest of the day.
So a guy employing seminary students was able to make money is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they actually, the guy who was sort of like the guy that ran everything was a seminary guy himself.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So, and then the other guy, we had a really, really great framer who was a, you know, a real veteran and, you know, we were competent, but he was obviously the best, you know, of the bunch. And so I did that for a couple of years. I enjoyed that a lot.
Studying, were you guys talking about classes on while you're framing the deck?
Oh yeah. While we're framing decks, we're arguing about theology and stuff like that.
Clients was, like, I'm not going out there right now.
Yeah. Well, often we were working on new construction. So we would get a contract with the subdivision, you know, and we'd put up all the decks. You know, in that. And some of the decks were pretty involved. I remember this was like late 1980s. And I remember doing a $100,000 deck. Yeah. It had seven levels that went down a mountain.
Wow. a lot of structural stuff that you had to do, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, we had, you know, there was the hot tub place. There was the fire pit place. You know, everything you could possibly do with a deck, that guy did. Yeah. And it was all, you know, Western red cedar, you know, so the framing was, you know, PT.
That's a $300,000, $400,000 deck these days.
Yeah, right.
Maybe more than that.
Yeah. But as you know, working with red cedar is like cutting butter. It smells great. Mm. It's, you know, I remember being in the, you know, it's summer in Kansas City and we'd all have our shirts off in the sunshine and they were just covered with sawdust.
Like dust of sawdust.
That's right. And you're surrounded by that aroma. It was great. And
you could have done a calendar shoot right there. The seminary student calendar shoot, huh?
That's right. That would have been amusing.
Yeah. Probably get you in trouble at this point in time. Somebody would dig that up on you.
Right. Anyway, so that's how I learned how to use my hands. Was during those days. And then I did a lot of, when I got into, you know, being, you know, in the rental real estate world, I worked on all my own stuff. I mean, even today I work on all my own stuff. Now all my stuff's back in Connecticut. My second son manages everything.
Okay.
And he's a welder. He works for United Steel. He's super competent furniture builder. There's nothing he can't do, you know? So I'm in a very good spot where I can just say, hey, Gabe, go over and install the dishwasher, you know, that kind of thing. It's just done. So, and my oldest son is pretty competent too. So, you know, and they worked with me when they were young, you know, when they were boys, they would help me out on the different job sites and at, you know, the different apartments. So anyway, that's how I acquired at least my construction skills.
Deck building was the main point where gave you the ability to branch out into other things.
Cause you're
watching houses go up around you. There's a bunch of different trades working there.
Yeah.
And and your conversion experience was very intertwined with manual labor too.
Oh yeah. I've got very high regard, much respect for the trades. You know, I'm pretty good with a knife when it comes to sheetrock. I'm pretty good with trim, obviously framing. So those are the basics. I'm passable. I can do some rudimentary plumbing, rudimentary wiring, that kind of thing. When it gets too complicated, you know, I call in somebody, but that's, you know, it's enough to kind of take care of most of the things you have to deal with.
Well, I really was personally convicted when I read the part about, like, it's not about necessarily whether you can get a washing machine for cheaper with respect to your time. It's about being frugal and then also just that additional general competency. And so I've tried to do some, since reading Man of the House, I've tried to do some stuff with auto mechanic type stuff, because all of us will stay where we're comfortable. And I feel like that even just, it's easy even when you own your own businesses or where you say, oh, well, I can make this much an hour, just throw it out. And in some ways that comes into competition with the preservation side or the stewardship side of a Christian. So that was convicting to me. And I've tried to do cheap fixes that maybe take a long time and frustrate, give me an opportunity to have good character with my children and not lose my patience and the many benefits of that.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes you're not going to have that work calling for you, you know, mm-hmm. right now we're in a kind of a sweet spot where there's a lot of demand and not enough contractors and that kind of thing. So you're probably busier than you want to be, but there'll come a time. I've been through it like 3 or 4 times now, where there's a pretty significant lull. And so at those times, you know, you got more time and you can actually put to use some of those skills and save some money. But I think another thing that's really important about general competency is that if you're conversant with, say, your mechanic, you know, then the person knows, hey, I can't just, you know,
put one over on him.
Yeah, BS this guy. I mean, he actually knows what's going on. You know, so that I think that's really helpful too.
Yeah, and I guess even just on the job site today, talking with the client, doesn't like what she's looking at, but she doesn't know how to get to the end state, and so you're sitting there translating for the carpenter and saying, "Hey, just pull that next layer off. I think this is what she's reacting to," and then they ought sometimes to say, "Hey, I understand. It's a change. We got you. Let's take care of it." And I like that aspect too. I guess specifically being able to say, "If you don't want your last half of your check, I'll finish this for you if you want." Like, you know, like if you're saying it can't really be done, I'll do it for you right now.
Right. Right. Yeah. That has a way of motivating people.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that would be sometimes the difference between some of the laborers that you have that are working for a guy and then somebody that owns the business. And I would say I've been encouraging Christian families, you know, you talk about it, and then in durable trades, there's this post-industrial revolution model of the family. And then there's maybe a pre-industrial revolution. And then even just seeing Western and Eastern family methodologies being different. And can you talk about, I guess, even just saying in our current climate, you know, some people, it's speculation, obviously, but there's potentially a lull on the horizon, not too distant horizon. You can't keep creating currency like you're doing. You can't keep doing these different policies, paying people to stay at home. Where's that money coming from? You know, what would be your kind of advice, or what do you see, you know, Christian families and men specifically not doing a good job? And then maybe some steps to, hey, this is what you need to get in order and get in order fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think with regard to the lull, I mean, if you can bring your debt way down, that'll be a big help. If you get a good cash position, that's a great help. But I think if you have a range of skills that give you a lot of options, you know, then if you find yourself, you know, for example, you're self-employed, you own a business, there are going to be times when there are, you know, slow seasons. And if you have a range of other things that you can fall back on, it's great. So like in my case, I was involved before the last crash back in 2008. I was involved with helping small investors liquidate their holdings because a lot of folks knew what was coming. And so after that, of course, you know, I was out of the ministry. I was kind of between churches at that point. Because I had some skills, I actually, and there was some pent up demand for like home improvement. I did that for a couple of years. So the real estate sales dried up, but then there was opportunities. And so I built a cabin for somebody, you know, a handicap ramp, and, you know, different things. And, so that was stuff that, I was able to do
a wide range of stuff in the building trades, but not in the genre that you had already done necessarily. But your general competency allowed you to do it, figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. So I built a cabin for an artist out in the middle of the woods. So I had a Jeep, Wrangler, and I would just drive way back into the woods, and I just had a generator and all my power tools, and was out there most of the time working by myself. I remember when I was laying out the piers, you know, and had them all poured and everything. And then I, you know, was putting down the beams, you know, for the structure that I could put the, you know, frame the floor on. And I had this really long beam and got caught up on the strong tie. You know how it is, you know? And so I'm struggling with this thing. And the next thing you know,
it just sliding down to the bottom.
Right. It slams down on my hand.
Oh.
And I'm out in the middle of the woods in nowheresville. And I mean, it was pretty painful.
Yeah.
I ended up losing a nail over that one. But it was one of those moments where you're like, wow, I'm all out here all alone. I could die and not be found for a little while.
Yeah. Your hand could have been stuck in there still.
Right. And, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would, but you know, I don't know why I went down that trail, but
yeah, but, no, I think that it's your, that is, the ability to understand. I think that, having kind of that spidey sense in those situations to understand how much on the ragged edge that you're running, and being able to make that decision in austere situations, you know, I'm maybe hanging it out a little bit too much. Right now,
yeah, I think. Yeah, I would bring in people after that to help out a little bit every now and then.
Yeah, for sure. One of the handymen were there working today at the job, and we went down and flipped off the breaker that said dryer. Okay. Saw the orange wire come out. We went to the other end, cut the sheetrock, saw the orange wire coming up, and they were about to start messing and moving because we're trying to get the dryer vent perfectly right. And I said, hey, let's plug the dryer in and check it. Oh, same color. I was like, well, I've grabbed a 60 amp wire before while I was working. And so that's just my standard, is I plug something in and I make sure, even though everything lines up, and we plugged it in and we hit the dryer and it beeped. So that it was still hot. I was about to grab a hold of this plug and try to kind of move it to the other stud. And it's just, those are the things is a small example of how that knowledge helps you save someone else.
Oh yeah. I've almost been electrocuted a couple of times because of things like that.
Well, and I think that general competency in the time that we're in, and being somebody that has a bunch of skills, you talk about with Jonathan on his podcast, that productive property, in some sense, that general competency is intellectual property. That's stuff in your mind that you keep with you forever that you can turn into money. It makes you better at helping people around you. If you have financial margin, if you have knowledge to be, say, hey, guy, hey, wait a second. And I told the guy, I said, hey, I just saved your life, you know, and you need to tell everybody about how I saved your life from here on out. You know, like, I got you, man. Like, you need to pick up the phone when I need something in the future, you know, everything, because we just saved you, man. And so I think that's in those situations when things are crazy, or when things are, you potentially could have something go wrong, and can say, well, let's hold up for a second. There's going to be more of that in uncomfortable times.
Well, you know, you just demonstrated a kind of practical intelligence that often academics don't possess. Academics can be so caught up in their own, you know, mental, I guess, egotism, that they really kind of lose sight of just really very fundamental sort of, kind of a fundamental need to stay in touch with the world and its realities. I actually think that if academics, generally speaking, had one foot in, say, the trades, we would have a lot less nonsense in the academic world. A lot of that stuff that you see kind of being promoted in that world and sort of finding its way out even into the larger world and politics and entertainment is due to the fact that these people have never actually ever done anything physically with their hands. You just, you know, the physical world is the reality check. You know, you can spend all day building these sandcastles in your mind, but reality will just wash them all away.
Yeah. Would you maybe lump pastors in that, category? Not to make you speak ill of your partners here in the ministry, but I mean, that's one of the things when I read your bio on the back of Man of the House. And then when we talked in person out in South Dakota, it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure I can get along with this guy. We can get over any theological issues, being united in our understanding of the physical world and those realities.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think I would say the same thing for pastors. I really do think pastors should learn to work with their hands, you know, work on their own car, whatever. And it has to do with a few things. One of the things is what you just noted, being able to relate to people. So I think a lot of guys who are blue collar are, I guess, disenchanted with the church because they can't really respect the, you know, the clergy for different reasons. You know, there's sort of a sense of the clergy being out of touch with the lives they lead. And clergy sometimes can just be at kind of an aesthetic level unpleasant to kind of interact with. You know, they just don't have the kinds of I guess tastes and interests that a lot of regular guys have. So if you can have a foot in the real world and you have some calluses on your hands, you can command the respect of a wider range of people than maybe you would otherwise. And I mean command in the right sense, and I'm not like respect me. I'm not talking like that. I'm just talking about the way you conduct yourself.
Gravitas.
Right, right.
Bringing it closer to home. What are you seeing kind of in the households of the church and things that you're focusing on with the men in your church and in your communities that you're saying, like, these are kind of pillars of the household and things that men should be cultivating with their wives? And, you know, maybe it can be in the negative or even the positive, you know, things that are showing themselves now in the culture because of the family being the way it is, you know, more on that.
Yeah. I'm at a church right now that's a very good church for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons is that when it comes to their understanding of households, pretty solid. It's, you know, they knew about me. I didn't know about them, and they invited me out because of the things I had written that were kind of in harmony with the way they were already thinking. So we've got a lot of guys in the church who are quite capable when it comes to, you know, the trades, business, that kind of stuff. And their wives are very supportive and involved in their lives in all kinds of ways. And we've got a lot of big families. So fruitfulness and having, you know, children who are being raised to glorify God, that's a big part of everything. It kind of, as I look out beyond kind of the boundaries of my church, I mean, I think in the larger evangelical world, you know, there's a real crisis right now in kind of, you know, a self-understanding what it means to be a man, what the purpose of a household is, how men and women should relate to each other. All those kinds of things are just big issues everywhere I look. And kind of the more sort of big Eva or sort of like seeker sensitive, you know, sort of the outlook of a particular church is, the worse it gets. So, you know, I think a lot of blue collar kind of churches, which tend to be, you know, smaller and unknown, you know, and they're spread out all over the place in sort of different parts
rural
of America.
Areas.
Yeah, those places are still okay. I mean, they're feeling the pressures that everybody feels in our culture, but I think that they're not in the kind of crisis that some of these, you know, sort of headline churches are. I mean, I think a lot of those churches are in a bad spot because of not just those things with wokeism and the other things I'd mentioned, but just the COVID stuff. I mean, you know, those churches have completely swallowed the government directives, hook, line, and sinker, and they're sinking because of it. I mean, a lot of them are in crisis financially, members, all kinds of ways.
Yeah. Well, and in some ways, I feel like that there is a tendency, specifically as men, I feel like, you know, going through COVID, and I'm a deacon at our church, so I get to see some of what's going on as I'm working and managing, you know, the building and the hands and feet side of things. But I think there's a real crisis that we all face to want to please and everybody. And we have this democratic means of leadership. And that's ingrained kind of in American culture, that majority rules, or even the loudest minority rules.
Yeah,
because they in a sense scare cowardly leadership into complying, and instead of there being a truthful foundation, it's not there. And I think that, you know, Michael Foster talked about that white knight syndrome, which I think just nails it on the head. You know, is it truly just to try to make this person not upset? What are they upset about? And is that something Christ would say is a priority?
Right. Yeah. If we have confidence that God is leading us, then when we are taking a position that may be a little risky, but we think is in keeping with the truth, then, you know, there'll be some fallout, but we'll find ourselves on the other end of that in a better place most of the time. So, yeah, I mean, the idea of conflict avoidance at all costs is a real problem. I think that this is another way that maybe pastoral education is not providing the kind of preparation that we would like or should expect. So like my friend Aaron Wren, I don't know if you're familiar with Aaron, but he wrote something that just was published here a couple of days ago in First Things about the need for mental toughness for pastors. And, you know, and it's because
I just had two podcasts ago did a mental toughness thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that article out.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically his point is that, you know, conflict avoidance is impossible right now. So don't even think that it's something you should pursue.
Yeah.
It's just the way things are. There's going to be some conflict. And, you know, what is, you know, who is your model? I mean, you know, look at the Apostle Paul. There's a guy who, you know, wrote a whole beautiful chapter on love and had a way of offending everybody all the time.
Yeah.
Riots would start, you know, when he came to town and he was beaten and just all kinds of stuff, you know? So, yeah, I think that we just need to accept, okay, there's going to be some rough days, stormy weather every once in a while, and just kind of accept that.
Yeah. I think the aspect of, we had just recently at my pastor, I went over, I kind of invited myself over after church and was like, we just talk about this stuff. I know you probably tracked the tweet heard around the world recently where the pastor was talking about modesty on Twitter.
Oh yeah. Yeah, then, yeah. Yeah.
Brian Sylvay and Eric Kahn, and they did a discussion about it. And I have been in some ways at this point delicate with how I treat some of this stuff. And I'm trying to lay a foundation and say, here's the truth. And I felt convicted even just talking with my pastor, because initially I was kind of on the side of like, man, you're going on Twitter and you're saying these things. What do you think is going to happen? You know, and don't go on Twitter and do that. Just preach to your church and you got what you deserved, kind of was where I was. But then even pulling Paul's talking to Timothy and saying to avoid foolish, but in some ways that was stuff that came after he spoke the truth.
Yeah,
that wasn't never speak the truth. That wasn't never offend. That was the continuation of people's reactions after, was my pastor kind of pointed out to me. And that really reframed things for me. Yeah. I don't know what your thoughts are on some of that.
Yeah. You know, I've never met Brian personally, but I remember when he kind of posted something on Facebook about this big flare up. And if I remember correctly, he wasn't talking about anyone in particular. You know, he just said,
he actually used Christian verbiage that may have been lost to the culture because they don't know how Christian, but he was addressing Christian.
Yeah.
Women. Christian, they just Christian, missed it.
Yeah. Just, you know, if you say Christian women, please don't, you know, post pictures of yourself in, you know, these situations and then in this, these states of undress.
Yeah.
That was it. You know, who can have an issue with that? You know, but apparently some people did, and some people pretty high up in the evangelical world, to name a name, Beth Moore, you know, I saw her initial response before she took it down. I was like, what is your issue, woman? You know, you know, anyway.
Yeah. And I guess that would be, you know, I really like Doug's framework about principles of war and then there being a difference between principles and then means and methods that change with time. So I guess it would be interested to hear your thoughts on, you know, we have these principles about the truth, about what a marriage is, what a productive household should be, having productive property, but then the means and methods that we should be using in this as men specifically, but then maybe families in the church, the current means and methods that we should be employing as men and women of the faith, specifically men.
Yeah, I think, you know, men should endeavor to lead the way in bringing productive property back home. So that's not to imply that working for somebody else is a bad thing or anything like that. It's just, so like I'm a pastor. I mean, I've obviously served the church, and that occupies a lot of my time, but I also have productive property that I own, you know, apart from that. So I think that the ownership of a productive property is something anyone can aspire to, even a person who works for somebody else. But if you bring it home and you're the one who kind of leads the way with it, you should also find ways for your family members to kind of work with you on it.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the big benefits of having it. So like, you know, in our situation, my kids, my wife over the years, we had, you know, 18 tenants at one time, and we had lots of things going on with the different units, and they all had some role at some point to play in things. So like sometimes I'd take my daughter with me when a tenant had moved out, and I'd have her clean the place, you know, clean the stove, all that kind of stuff, or have my sons work with me on the outside or different things. So there was always something to do. And then I think it's a good thing to kind of assess the abilities of the people in your household and the interests that they have, and think about ways that you can encourage them to work, you know, and pursue those interests in a way that serves the household. You know, when they're at home, your household that they dwell in, but later on, hopefully, you know, the homes that they establish and find a mate to help work with in that household. So like in my case, each of my kids pursued their interests and were, you know, getting different things going from home that have in each case has led to their current means of livelihood and the kinds of things that they're doing. So like my oldest son is a musician and now lives in Nashville, and he's got a studio and it's at home. He's got the studio at home. And
this is the one that edits the podcast too?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's Caleb. So he's got that, and he's got a number of clients, you know, everybody from, you know, other podcasters. He's got a number of podcasts, number of churches, Lifeway music, and, you know, those guys that he works with them. So he's got a lot of different things going on, but he owns his own business and he's at home, and his wife is in education, and they're right now kind of working through, they just had their first child, and she obviously wants to be with the baby all the time, but yeah, you know, she's got abilities in with regard to her background in education. And so, you know, they're thinking all along the lines of how do we get things going with her to, you know, sort of bring an income that she can, you know, use the gift that she has. Cause like Caleb doesn't need her to, you know, help out with what he's doing, except maybe in certain times, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is there stuff that she can do? And so they're working on that. So like in my situation, my wife is a piano teacher. She's got about, at any given time, 25 to 35 students. So there's steady stream of people coming through the house.
Yeah.
It's been like that for years. And then she also does hair. She's a hairdresser. So our household has always been a place where there's been a lot of productive activity. And my second son learned kind of his blacksmithing skills in his shop in the garage.
At your house.
Yeah.
So you had to buy a forge for him and stuff and help set that up? Or
No, he built his own forge.
Okay. At your house.
Yeah. Yeah. So he built a couple of forges at the house, and he's really good. I mean, he even cast his own rings, his wedding rings.
Wow.
He's kind of like Ron Swanson. He can do like anything, you know. You ever see that episode with Ron Swanson where he makes the rings?
I'm very familiar with the theology according to Ron Swanson stuff, the books and the, you know, but I don't think I've seen that particular episode.
Oh, it's hilarious. Look it up, because there's actually a scene from Parks and Recreation where they forgot the rings. So they're at a wedding, they forgot the rings. And so Ron says, hey, let me take care of this for you. And he goes in the back and he pulls a sconce off the wall and he melts it down.
Yes, and he casts, this is life on target material for sure.
And he casts their rings on a waffle iron.
Yes.
And he says, there they are. He said, it took me all of 20 minutes.
Yeah, no problem. I'm a man.
That's right. Yeah. But anyway, my second son actually did that. But anyway, so, and then my daughter, she's a baker. And I kind of think about your household with your kids as kind of like a skunk works, you know, like, you know, starting new enterprises, new businesses. What are your interests? Mm-hmm. What are you into? That kind of thing. How are you going to make money? Yeah. So like my daughter is a fabulous, you know, fabulous with knitting and stuff like that. I mean, pretty high end stuff. But she's realized that, you know, in order to be paid at the level that she would need to be paid to survive, she would starve, you know, with the projects that so she thought on her own.
Well, there's probably a demand. The majority of the demand is much more lower level, mediocre work than she's capable of. And so that's the ceiling in that market. You're not paying. And in my old, everybody that leaves the military from my line of work goes into shooting instruction.
Right.
But there's the difference between a ranger that's been in 6 years and a guy that went my route and did more things or whatever, from the vast majority of the market doesn't identify the difference. They don't know nothing. And so to get paid that premium, and it's a saturated market. There's so many guys that are war veteran that are in our market right now, you know, and there's just not a demand for that at a level that I can feed my family, you know?
Yeah. One of the things I talk to my kids about is, what is your cutting board business? So anyway, there's a story behind this. So there's a documentary about a guy, I think he's up in Minnesota. He's a high-end furniture maker, makes beautiful stuff. I mean, you're talking like $20,000 desks and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, that's a pretty rarefied kind of thing. And sometimes kind of the hours invested, even at that price point, doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the margin is not there.
Right. So it's like what he did is he started a cutting board business, like the most boring thing you could ever do.
Yeah. You know,
but he has his high volume cutting board business. So he supplies the cutting boards for like Crate and Barrel and these different places.
Okay.
And so he's got this boring business and his wife works on that. And he's got a couple of guys who work for him on that. And that frees up his time to make this high end furniture. So like when I talk to my kids, I'm like, what's your cutting board business? You know, what's the thing that's kind of the steady, boring income that frees up the time for you to do the stuff that you really love to do, or would be the thing you're growing into?
What was it? Do you know, remember the name of that documentary or anything, or what you
Yeah, I wish I did. It's let me see.
I can try to find it and put it in the show notes. Cause that seems like something that I like, especially letting my kids see that and letting it take an hour or two to let them physically understand what's going on with that business. And then that becomes that, like you said, that what's your cutting board business, and becomes this mantra. The discussions on that with your kids, when did you start that? And when was the, because you're saying you're identifying the talents and you're saying, how are you going to make money? And I guess specifically what I'm reacting to on that, in my household, my father's household growing up, I have five sisters.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we emphasized the fruitfulness of a wife and a mother in our home. And it was great.
Sure.
And my dad owns his own businesses and does things. And I got that from him. But in some ways, if I'm being like really harsh in the critique, and something that I'm trying to kind of do with my kids is, and my daughter specifically, is it's okay for a woman to make money. Mm-hmm. And I'm specifically benefiting with my wife helping me manage our Airbnbs, and she's styling them, and she's picking colors, and she's, you know, we're even looking at potentially selling one, because we're having these talks about where our debt is and where, and what the market's doing. And hey, maybe it's actually a good position to exchange productive property and sell it. And she's helping, you know, manage the brokers and do the write-ups and photography. And it's all happening today while I'm under these crawl spaces and things. And I'm just, you know, I texted her right before. I said, thank you for doing these things that nobody sees.
Right.
That the wife is just back there, just crushing it. And then sometimes that we get caught in this thing that we got to go off to the office.
Right.
And then just, hey, woman, handle everything. That's what a godly woman does. You just handle this, you know, you clean up the spit up. And in some ways, as men, we're hurting Christ's cause, because we're putting the women in this pretty narrow spectrum of what they're capable of. And our daughters even growing them up and saying, you can be industrious. You see that in Proverbs 31. You can make money. And
I think that many women would actually blossom in a setting where they could do all the things that God made them do in terms of motherhood and working with their husbands, but also have, you know, some kind of creative outlet that either directly tied to the family business or maybe a sub business within a larger kind of household structure. So that's how it's always worked for us. And I think that we shouldn't be at all shy about that.
When did you start having those discussions, or what did those go with your kids, kind of to plant those seeds and then let, and also I guess that balance of not like you said, oh, he built his own forge. I immediately went to like, that would be buying a forge for him is taking away the learning and the general competency that would come from, I give you the corner of the garage, but you go figure that out now.
That goes back a long way. So, you know, even as little people, you know, I was, you know, I kind of kept my eye on them and was looking for their gifts, and I would try to encourage them in their gifts. So like my oldest son, he was the athlete. So his first word was ball.
Yeah. ready to go.
Ready to go. So, he played for the town baseball team. You know, he played basketball in high school, all these different things. My second son had no interest in athletics, but he was, he had a good hand and a good eye when it came to making things. Mm-hmm. And then he also had this remarkable capacity for figuring out the most efficient way to do things. Like I'm a putterer. My overseers would always be frustrated with me because I was not efficient in my movements and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I noticed with my second son, he would stand there. He'd look at the job, whatever I gave him to do. I wouldn't tell him exactly what to do. I'd tell him what needed done. And he'd figure out the most efficient way to do it. Now, probably because he wanted to go do something else.
Yeah. No, it's that that's I talk about how in homeschooling, like that I didn't have to do it to time, but that was to standard. You finish these math lessons, you're done with school. And why I like homeschooling is because you get to, as a kid, learn if I can do the work efficient, I can be done with the work early, and then I can go do something else. And that's extremely valuable for a young person to be able to do. Oh, yeah, and then specifically, like you're saying, it seems like you're giving him a job, like give an example, maybe an age where you're seeing that for him. Can you think of?
Yeah, I can think of a particular situation. I had him, we were working on a chicken coop together. And I wanted him to enclose it, you know, with the wire. And I just said, here's the materials, here are the tools. He'd used them many times before. And then I was walked away and just let him work on it. And, I kind of looked at him every once in a while as he was kind of, you know, proceeding with the job. And I realized that he was doing it very efficiently. There wasn't a lot of wasted movement or anything like that. I thought this kid is kind
of made. He knew I got to run this vertical, not horizontal, because of 36 inches. And he was figuring that kind of stuff out to not a bunch of overlap or whatever kind of things.
Yeah. He had that down pretty easy, but it just even in terms of how he laid out the wire and how he approached the job, you know, and just the whole thing.
So what age would that be? Like generally you think?
Well, he was maybe 11 or 12 at that point.
Okay. Yeah. So he knows the tools. He's had his hands on them.
Yeah.
You know, and I know I face for a guy that's competent, it's very hard for me to watch my 9-year-old and my 13-year-old struggle through stuff. And in some ways it's convicting for me to be like, I mean, I've done too much already for them. And they're not, they should know, like they should know the trailer. They should know where everything is. And then, you know,
Here's a funny story. So my second son learned to drive on a standard, you know, stick shift. And my wife was kind of helping with the process, and she was, you know, in the car while he was driving, and he was doing what every kid does when they're learning, you know, they're stalling out all over the place and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I told my wife, I said, here's the thing, leave him in the parking lot down the street and just come home in the other car. And when he gets it, he'll drive home. So he had to figure out
how the conditions for them to learn.
Right. If you want to come home, this is, you're going to have to learn to drive this.
Nice.
So he's a master at it now, but that's how he kind of got over that kind of, because, you know, like when you're in a car and you're trying to figure, you know, learn something new, or in any setting, your attention is divided between the person who's watching you and what you're doing, and you're self-conscious. You're just sort of like thinking, I don't want to look stupid. And you end up looking stupid because you are so concerned about looking stupid.
Yeah.
But if you had just been left alone, you would have figured it out a lot faster, you know?
That's worth the podcast for me. Say, hey son, I'm going to go work on this. Good luck. And cause I think that specifically with fathers, that is probably between fathers and sons is huge. Not wanting to disappoint dad.
Yeah.
Not wanting to mess up. And there's literally probably, I can even just see my kid's face right now, that there's this 90% of the bandwidth that should be allocated to the task is allocated to what's dad think of this right now.
Yeah. It's important to let kids alone sometimes so they can figure things out.
Mm, awesome. I guess one of the things too, I would say is you had a round table with Michael Foster and Doug, and you talked kind of dominion. And one of the things with this podcast is like, when I start talking to people, I'm going to talk stuff that I want to know from these guys. And I'd say, you know, what are you saying to these Christian men that are in different positions where they're talking to people or where they're around people about what's important to be discussing, what's important to be you to be focusing on as a man individually? I kind of have been building the, you know, the self family, church, concentric circles that build on each other, you know, and then just how we're engaging in the culture, where we are and what we're focusing on as men.
Yeah, I think that's great. Keep it up.
Vaze, what are your
what am I doing?
What are your are you doing specifically your strategies for how you order your day?
Okay.
And how that maybe relates to productivity, to efficiency, to having dominion over the whole self and things like that.
I tend to break up my day into like three parts.
Okay.
So I, for me, like about 4 hours is about as much as I can give to any task and sort of stay focused. So like the mornings are generally given over to intellectual work. So, you know, writing, working on sermons, that reading, you know, kind of heavy reading, that kind of thing. The afternoons generally are more for like the kind of necessary administrative tasks, you know, communication, meeting with people. I try to use my meal times to connect with guys. So I've got a fairly big entertainment budget wherever I have served, because I'm probably taking guys out to eat maybe three times a week for lunch.
Okay.
I'll do my morning thing, meet with a guy for lunch. We'll talk about anything. You know, we'll talk about family issues, work issues, you know.
Those mainly in your church?
Yep. Yep. Mainly. Yeah. Although I have an increasing demand on my time is due to a lot of guys reaching out to me. Like tomorrow, my entire afternoon is phone calls. So one after another of these guys who have wanted to talk to me about something. Very often it's stuff related to like productive property and stuff like that. You know, how do I get going with this or that? You know? So, you know, I talk with them a little bit about that. And then, you know, the evenings are often for entertainment and stuff. So now when I was back in Connecticut and I had all my tools in my shop, you know, I was probably maybe two, sometimes even 3 days a week in the afternoons working on something physical. I miss that. I don't have my stuff here. So, you know, if I'm here long-term, I got to remedy that. I think I might go crazy.
You're going to buy a whole new set of tools? Or are you going to have to transport them?
Probably the cost of moving them would be, you know, the same as buying a whole new set.
I like the logic. You got to get a whole new, another set for sure.
That's right. Yeah. So I still have my place back in Connecticut. So I'm back there maybe every couple of months. And so I probably should just keep that stuff there because I have all sorts of things I can use it for there. But if I do something here, it'll probably be when I, as I've thought about building a house out here. So if I do that, I'll definitely have some dedicated space for, you know, shop.
Nice. And you have your license out there now as well, or did you go through the, or they have some allowances to let a homeowner leave his own?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I have to look into it. I haven't done a whole lot of thinking about that yet, but something I've wanted to do for a while. And we got a lot of great timber out here. There's a lot of, you know, great phenomenal Douglas fir and all that kind of stuff. So I'd love to do like a timber frame, kind of small timber frame, you know, maybe real small, maybe not huge, because, you know, it's just my wife and me now. Yep. So I have this dream of like doing maybe a 1500 square foot, really nice finished home for her and me. And then maybe having like a bunkhouse in the back for all the grandkids, you know, when they come to visit, and then maybe a shop, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. I guess this would be kind of out of left field. What do you think about the cryptocurrency thing? You talk about a cash position.
Yeah.
I haven't really touched that, but I've actually had several people say, what do you think about this? And some people are saying this and say, well, I know I don't know enough to prescribe myself as an expert, but I know I own some, you know, as a hedge in a sense. Cause I've read some stuff where you talk about a hedge being, you put something in, you diversify yourself so that when one goes down, the other goes up, and that's what a hedge is for a household in a sense. So, or maybe some other ways you feel, you talked about being competent, generally competent, being able to diversify what you do as potentially a hedge, but other things that you see.
Yeah. I don't know enough about the crypto world. This whole NFT thing is just really crazy. I don't know if you're familiar with that, the non-fungible tokens. You know, Doug Tenapple, you know, made like $1 million on that last, you know, like in 6 months last year.
Yeah.
What in the world? And then you look at him and say, people paying that kind of money for that?
Darren Doan told me that I should make my builds NFTs and that we should put into the contract a royalties every time the house sells. Which is in typical Darren Doan fashion. I felt like a genius. It's like, this is great. Yeah. You know, it's like everybody's paying 3% for brokers, whatever. If you have 0.5% in there and you build this portfolio of homes that you sold that then become productive property indefinitely. It's like, wow, that's pretty cool.
That is great. Yeah. I, I'll have to think about that.
Yeah. When you build that timber frame house, you make it an NFT.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I don't know anything about it. I just look at the stuff and I say, man, there's some people making a lot of money here. And I'd like to understand it a little better, but I don't have the kind of the time and the energy to invest in it. But I'm kind of at the stage of life. I'm going to be 60 this year. So kind of a stage of life where I'm like, okay, what's my strategy for the next 20 years? How do I invest myself? Do I want to get into this whole new stuff, or do I want to just kind of build on things I've already done? At the moment, I'm just kind of building on things I've already done.
Yeah. You said you have people reaching out to you, asking you first steps, productive property. What are you saying? I know you say start a business, you know, the quote unquote side hustle. What are some other steps that guys in the corporate slave era could do right now?
I keep giving this particular piece of advice and no one has taken me up on it. but my advice is that if you're in the market for your first home, buy a two family. Mm-hmm. It seems to me to be the most sort of easy way to get into the rental business. And all of the advantages of, you know, of home ownership are yours, because you still get, you know, the residential rates up to four units, you know, in terms of interest rates and that kind of stuff, and first time home buyer stuff. And then you have the income. And then if you have an issue with your tenant, you know, an absentee landlord doesn't mean that you live in one part of the country and all your tenants are in another part. It just means that you don't live in the building that your tenants live in. So in that situation, the center of gravity is moved in the direction of the tenant. Yeah. But when you live in the place, the center of gravity moves toward you, and the courts defend your interests in a way that you don't experience when you're an absentee landlord. So, you know, if you bought a two family, it's not like you're going to necessarily sort of be at the mercy of your tenant. Your tenant's going to be at your mercy. You can vacate that unit almost at will. You know, the only thing it would restrict you is if you had, you know, a lease. So it's a good way to get in to a property. And then when you do that, if you get it at a good price, then, you know, you're probably paying less out of pocket because of the income coming from the rent than you would be otherwise if you just bought a single family. And then you could find yourself in a position where maybe the second house you buy is the single family, and now you got your rental, you know.
Almost exactly how it happened for us. We had a single family home that we fixed, but then our second one is a duplex. And we lived in one while we fixed the other one up. And then as soon as we moved, I mean, literally my wife and I are throwing trash bags and furniture that we don't want out of the rental the night prior, because we were just shuffling through the yard. But it was incredible to have our mortgage paid for the entire time we lived there, essentially. And then I would say even in Airbnbs, it doesn't even have to be a separate unit. In some ways it can be it's crazy how people will rent a place and they can lock the door and they can't see, you know, and you got to protect your household, but there's just ways to rent the basement out, rent the, a room that is got a different entrance and just start getting that. Is there anything else besides that, the duplex side or the two unit?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that you did that. That's how I got started too. I think that, you know, another thing would be to keep your eyes open for people that you can learn from. Mm. So, you know, mentors are people that you learn from. When you enter into a relationship with somebody that you're learning from, it doesn't mean that you have like some kind of formal, you're my mentor kind of relationship. Yeah. It just means that you get together with the guy every once in a while and kind of talk about life. Yeah. And so if you can have some guys that you can look toward who are further along than you are and know things you don't know, and just be your friend and maybe get together with them every once in a while for coffee or lunch or something, and just glean that wisdom from those guys, that would be another big thing you could do.
Awesome. Well, I think you've been gracious with your time. Everybody's getting in line to talk with you. I appreciate you taking time to speak. I think a lot of guys are going to get value out of this and some practical things. That's why I like your experiences. How can people buy your books? I would guess, because I haven't spent a dollar on Amazon this year. We expect that we will, but we had a couple Audible credits, but we stopped that thing. We canceled Prime and I started trying to buy books local. But as an author, how can guys buy your books and how can I recommend? Because I feel like the man of the house is in the masculinity canon these days to read, but what's the way that helps you the most and what you recommend?
Oh, well, you know, I've never looked down at the breakdown when I get the royalty statement of where people get the books.
Yeah, your productive property.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, you can just go to the publishers themselves. You know, that's Whiff and Stock for Man of the House, and then Canon for the stuff I do with them. Yeah. But you can also go to your local bookstore and order the stuff. I mean,
they get it from the publisher, likely, right, or distributor, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you can get even different online sources. If there's a particular online source you like to use, any of these things that I've written are available through those channels. So there are different ways to go about it.
And then the theology podcast we'll listen to. I heard you mention a couple sermons. Does your church put those out online? Is there a way to get your sermons? The Talents one you spoke about with Jonathan West, and I immediately was like, man, I got to find his church's sermons. How's those get put out?
Yeah. Well, if you go to Sermon Audio and just type in C.R. Wiley, you'll have all my sermons wherever I've been. So it's, you know, whether at my church in Connecticut, my church here, or places I've preached, if they're part of Sermon Audio, they may not have put it up as C.R. Wiley. They may have put it up as Chris Wiley or Christopher Wiley, but you'll see a picture of me. That's how you can know it's me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I really appreciate you taking it. And we'll look forward to shooting guns together again.
All right. In the future. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Nate. I appreciate the invitation, and it's been fun.
Awesome. Thanks. Thank you for staying with us here with our first interview on the Life on Target podcast, Pastor C.R. Wiley. What a great conversation. Such an inspirational guy who is a man's man, practically walking out areas of this theology in his life. As always, if you got value from this podcast, please share it with someone else. Also, leave a review, 5-star, etc. Talk to you soon. Have a good one.